You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad asked us to refer to ourselves as the black man, the original people of the earth. And when we saw ourselves as black people, then every person of color on the earth, we identified with them. So in the 60s, nothing could happen on the African continent that black people in America were not concerned with. Nothing could happen in the Caribbean or in Brazil or in Central America or in the islands of the Pacific where black people were concerned that we didn't feel them, because a nervous system was being created for black people that we felt the pain of one another wherever we were on the earth. But after Malcolm was assassinated and Martin was assassinated and Elijah Muhammad was gone, notice the shift in language. We were no longer black. In New York City, there were several black shows. There was Black News. Was there Positively Black? Mm-hmm. There was the national program with Tony Brown called Black Journal.
Right.
After the death of these giants, now the wise people said, let's change the language so we can change their focus and give them a new understanding of who they are. So subtly, there was no more Black News, no more Positively Black. Black Journal became Tony's Journal. And all over America, wherever black was describing that program, Black Star in Baltimore, that left. And then the new language was the minority, the disadvantaged. Then came African American. And what was happening is a severing of the nervous system that black had made, tying us to the struggle of black people all over the world. So now there can be a Darfur. Who cares? That's not us. There can be a Rwanda and Burundi. Who cares? That's not us. So we don't feel suffering until there's a Katrina. Oh, that's us. But what's going on in Haiti? That's not us. What's going on in Brazil, in Costa Rica, in Colombia, in Nicaragua, in Guatemala? That is not us. So the language shift.
I'm black, whether I'm poor or rich or rich or poor, though it's all the same shit. I'm black, even though my skin's kinda light, that mean my ancestors by somebody white. I'm black, so I like to sing, dance, and crack jokes, eat good food and be around black. I'm black, so I like the oldies on Sundays, drink all night and still go to work Monday. I'm black, so I like my kids looking real nice, cause I've been poor and I know what it feels like. I'm black, and I'ma say it loud like James Brown. People be proud cause we all up in the game now. I'm black, and I'ma hold my right fist real high. I might see my man and we might get real high. I'm black, and I know it and I ain't afraid to show it. I'm black, and I'm a genius and a motherfucking poet. You know it.
Just who I am, so proud to say that I'm me. So proud to be just who I am, so proud to be so free. I'm black. So proud to say that I'm me.
I'm black.
The one of the struggle and the hate.
I'm black.
And I'm not afraid to say
I'm black.
Black.
I got a heart full of bravery, do it for my peoples that went through slavery. I'm black, so you know I'm young in the sports, 90% chance I get hung in the court. I'm black, don't you be scared of me, mister, cause you don't really seem to be scared of my sister. I'm black, and I could buy first class too, or buy an exotic car and like Merc pass you. I'm black, and I don't need a tan in the winter, mind strong and powerful, non-cypher can't enter. I'm black, and I don't need jewelry to shine, my skin color is like the jewelry is blind. I'm black, they focus on the negative attention, do something positive and never get mentioned. I'm black, listen, it's a fact, original man, I wouldn't change it if I could, and that's that.
Yeah. So proud to be just who I am, so proud to say that I'm me.
I'm black.
The hate.
perfection. Look in the mirror, see Malcolm and Martin reflection.
I'm black, just like the Panthers, looking for an answer. This prejudice, it's like a cancer.
I'm black.
Look in my eyes, the wool can't get pulled over. Look in my cars, I stay getting pulled
I'm
over.
Black.
Meaning public enemies, number one government. Looking in the hood, sending in the.
I'm black.
I grew up off the good times show. Drink liquor, smoke, then let the good times roll.
I'm black.
I live for my wife and my seeds and my mind with a bond only God could exceed.
I'm black.
I got to show my homeboys love. First thing you learned in the hood was homeboy love.
I'm black.
And I'm that if I ain't nothing else.
I'm black.
I'm beautiful. I love myself.
Love
yeah.
Myself. Just who I am.
So proud to say that I'm me.
So proud to be just who I am.
So proud to be so free.
I'm black.
So proud to say that I made it.
I'm black.
Even with the struggle and the hate.
I'm black.
And I'm not afraid to say
I'm black.
Black.
June 18th, 2008, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, Black Coffee Channel. Let me catch up on your posts. LA's off from Brooklyn. He says, regarding the online music store, would you be able to help me set it up? Well, I can tell you yes. You should have purchased them anyway, just because you want to be an incredible entrepreneur in the great Hebrew tradition. I don't know if an online music store is the best business for you, Elazar in Brooklyn. But we can talk about that. I want to hear your vision. I don't know if the online music store is what we need to have to get you what you need, Elazar. But we'll talk more. You can send some more questions through on air. Glenn from Philly. He says, I saw that Barack Obama mentioned reducing business taxes. Not a bad talking point to send out to fiscal conservatives. He has some economic advisors that definitely seems more supply side oriented, so that influence may help him craft a plan that appeals to the left and the right. Yeah, Glenn from Philly is always on top. I'm going through my inventory of articles. And just like that, unlike Lamar Odom, who the Lakers need to get rid of, I have this right in my hands ready to score. This article says, candidates' business advisors get heat. This is from the June 14th Wall Street Journal. It says here, the presidential campaign attack machines have taken aim at corporate executives advising the candidates by using the executives' past business activities as fodder. Both Democratic presidential contender Barack Obama and his Republican counterpart John McCain rely on former business executives for help on everything from fundraising to economic policy. At the same time, each has railed against corporate greed and vowed to root out corruption. The clash has already led to the resignation of one Obama advisor. On Wednesday, Democratic Party stalwart James Johnson quit as a screener of potential running mates for Senator Obama after new details emerged about loans that Mr. Johnson had received from mortgage lender Countrywide Financial Corp. Shortly after, Democratic operatives began pushing research on Carly Fiorina, a close advisor to Senator McCain related to the business dealings of Hewlett-Packard Company, while she led the tech titan, and to her compensation package after her ouster in 2005. Now, Glenn from Philly is referring to a big article in the Journal from about 2 days ago. Here's that article. Unlike Paul Gasol, I have it in my hands ready to score. Says here, Senator Barack Obama shed new light on his economic plans for the country, saying he would rely on a heavy dose of government spending to spur growth, use the tax code to narrow the widening gap between winners and losers in the U.S. economy, and possibly back a reduction in corporate tax rates. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, the Illinois Democrat said that he was trying to put together tax and spending policies that dealt with two challenges. One is the competition from rapidly growing developing countries like India and China. The other, the U.S. becoming what he called a winner-take-all economy, where the gains from economic growth skew heavily toward the wealthy. It goes on, says, Senator Obama's nod to lower corporate taxes comes as Republicans have been attacking him for proposals that would raise the cost of doing business, such as his pledge to raise the tax rate on capital gains and his vow to increase the top income tax rates, which are often used by small unincorporated enterprises. He didn't say how deeply he would cut the rate, but said it could be trimmed in return for reducing corporate tax breaks, simplifying the tax system. With existing loopholes, he said, how much you pay in taxes as a corporation a lot of times is going to depend on how good your lobbyist is. With a level playing field, he said, the rates could be reduced. Well, the great Barack Obama did come back. Maybe he heard the show where I told him that he needed to ease up on raising the capital gains tax rates back up to 28%. If you notice, he stopped saying 28. Now he says 20. Good move. What I really want him to do is to reduce the holding period on the capital gains tax in businesses that operate in enterprise communities and empowerment zones. I think I'm going to write an op-ed giving Senator Obama some advice to be published in the mainstream media. That's right. I'm taking the message and the gospel of the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program to the corporate media. Won't be the first time. I've written for the Wall Street Journal before. Maybe I'll send it to them. So Glenn from Philly on point. Now, again, with so many blacks having corporations and being entrepreneurs, it's wrong for Senator Obama to make it seem like the only people affected by corporate tax rates are big corporations. Most corporations are small businesses. Less than $6 million in revenue and 20 employees, according to the Small Business Administration definition, which is ridiculous. Okay? All right, let me catch up on the posts. You all are blowing me up here. That's Louis Armstrong, by the way. We'll talk about him. 80th anniversary of something. Rod Ginyard, do you hear me? It's great Louis Armstrong. Okay, if you are a... all my Church of KRS members, where are you? Rod Ginyard says, while this is on my mind, I must say that Susan Rice of the Barack campaign has the brightest rising star on his staff. She is direct, intelligent, unrepentant, and comes very correct. She's a Stanford grad and a Rhodes Scholar in international relations. She reminds me of Natasha, actually. Rod Ginyard continues, as much as Tim Russert is said to have researched his guests, he should have foreseen nearly all of the minister's comments. These are old questions, and the temper of the interview could have been elevated to a much higher level had he taken his research with more due diligence. Cameron from Paterson, New Jersey says, said, don't you think that Kevin Garnett waited a while to show up in the game? He had been relying on his short-range jumper and playing small. He and P.J. Brown were hurting the team at times. Last night, he showed. Pearson Allen played unafraid, and that hurt L.A. Ray Allen is the... I mean, can we stop? Let me put Louis Armstrong on pause. I mean, is there any debate why Boston really won? Is Ray... Jesus. Ray Allen. The great Jesus Shuttleworth. I think that's his name in that movie. Rod Ginyard says the impact of Tiger Woods missing the remainder of the tour for this year is huge. Every single venue will suffer, as well as all of the adjunct businesses that depend on his presence for their prosperity. This will become the biggest combination of financial and sporting news events. Rod Ginyard, as usual, you are on the money. I saw CNBC from what they said. Glenn from Philly can confirm this. Is the stock of Nike down today because of Tiger Woods' knee surgery? Tiger Woods going to miss the rest of the golf season. From what I saw, the stock of Nike is down. Janine Baptiste from Manchester, Connecticut. She says, hey, Cedric, was Farrakhan talking about Jesse Jackson or Barack Obama? Janine from Connecticut. Jesse Jackson. Do I have to play this again for the wonderful Janine Baptiste? I'm going to bring this back. This was in reference to the 1998. This was in 1998, so it was not referring to Senator Obama. I'm going to bring this back one more time. This is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan on Meet the Press. Here we go.
Reports in U.S. News and World Report today that Jesse Jackson is thinking of running for president in the year 2000. Would you support Reverend Jackson?
No, I will not. Support him for what? Support him for what? What is Jesse Jackson going to do? Jesse Jackson is a brilliant man. He knows he can't win any election against whoever the Republicans will put up. But so to gather more people to get in the process and then turn them over to Mr. Gore or somebody else? We are tired of these games that people play. Either you're going to do something for our people or let us go. Don't play with us anymore. Clinton moves to the right. The country has moved to the right. Blacks have been pushed out. I'm talking about the masses of black people. So if you're not going to give us justice, don't play with us. Let us go and let us do something for ourselves.
Okay, I think that's very clear that that's referring to the great Reverend Jesse Jackson running for president in 1998. Tim Russert asked the question and he received that answer. 80 years ago, what happened? Louis Armstrong. Let me read this article. My father actually put this in my hand. Black conservatives conflicted on Obama campaign. Black conservative talk show host Armstrong Williams has never voted for a Democrat for president. That could change this year with Barack Obama as the Democratic Party's nominee. I don't necessarily like his policies. I don't like much that he advocates for. But for the first time in my life, history thrusts me to really seriously think about it, Williams said. I can honestly say I have no idea who I'm going to pull that lever for in November, and to me that's incredible. Just as Obama has touched black Democratic voters, he has engendered conflicting emotions among black Republicans. They revel over the possibility of a black president, but wrestle with the thought that the Illinois senator doesn't sit beside them ideologically. Among black conservatives, Armstrong Williams said, they tell me privately it would be very hard to vote against him in November. Perhaps sensing the possibility of such a shift, Republican presidential candidate John McCain has made some efforts to lure black voters. He recently told Essence magazine that he would attend the NAACP's annual convention next month, and he noted that he recently traveled to Selma, Alabama, scene of the Seminole voting rights protests in the 1960s, and he talked about the need to include forgotten Americans. Now, you all remember, we played you the audio of Senator McCain's journey into black crowds. He looked very uncomfortable, although he was saying some very good things. Again, for the record, I had to say it. I want an exodus out of the Democratic Party in the level of 30%. I want 10% going to the Republican Party, 10% going Libertarian, 10% going Green. That's my little footnote. Let me continue with this article. Still, the Arizona senator has a tall order in winning black votes, no doubt made taller by running against a black opponent. In 2004, blacks chose Democrat John Kerry over President Bush by an 88% to 11% margin, according to exit polls. J.C. Watts, a former Oklahoma congressman who was once part of a GOP House leadership, said he's thinking of voting for Obama. Watts said he's still a Republican, but he criticizes his party for neglecting the black community. Black Republicans, he said, have to concede that while they might not agree with Democrats on issues, at least that party reaches out to them. And Obama highlights that even more, Watts said, adding that he expects Obama to take on issues such as poverty and urban policy. Republicans often seem indifferent to those things. Likewise, retired General Colin Powell, who became the country's first black Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, said both candidates are qualified and that he will not necessarily vote for the Republican. Quote, I will vote for the individual that I think brings the best set of tools to the problems of the 21st century America and the 21st century world, regardless of party, regardless of anything else that the most or regardless of anything else other than the most qualified candidate, Powell said Thursday in Vancouver. He said that outside the country, notice. In comments reported by the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Michael Steele, the Republican former lieutenant governor of Maryland who lost a Senate race there in 2006, said he is proud of Obama as a black man, but that come November, I will do everything in my power to defeat him. Electing Obama, he said, would not automatically solve the woes of the black community. I think people who try to put this sort of messianic mantle on Barack's nomination are a little bit misguided. John McWhorter, a self-described political moderate who was a senior fellow at the conservative Manhattan Institute and a New York Sun columnist, he said Obama's Democratic Party victory proves that while there is still some racism in the United States, there is not enough to matter in any serious manner. This is a watershed moment. Obama is probably more to the left than I would prefer on a lot of issues, he adds, but this issue of getting past race for real is such a wedge issue for me, and he is so intelligent, and I think he would be a perfectly competent president that I'm for him. I want him to get in because in a way it will put me out of a job. Okay, we're getting real close to the second cup topic for today's show, which was, is the phenomenal rise of Senator Barack Obama now being used as a device to mask America's racial divide? John McWhorter's comment gets to what I want to bring out more pronounced. He says, Obama is probably more to the left than I would prefer on a lot of issues. But this issue of getting past race for real is such a wedge issue for me. And he is so intelligent. And I think he would be a perfectly competent president that I'm for him. I want him to get in because in a way it will put me out of a job. What do you think? Glenn from Philly has confirmed. He says, peace said. He says, Nike opened up at $67 after closing at $68 yesterday. But I believe right now they are actually up a bit. Last quote I saw was $68.33. So Nike stock is not down. We'll keep our eyes on that. Daryl Atif Smith from Trotdale, Oregon. Welcome, Daryl. Daryl says, I believe there will be a rise in police abuse against black men due to the false belief that because of Obama's campaign, America has solved its racial issue. America is run by the philosophy of the three C's. If you're right, if you're from the right class, have the right color, and no consciousness, you can be free. Oh, man. Kenosha from Clinton, Mississippi. Of course, Obama's political success will certainly be used as a way to either de-emphasize or completely mask existing inequities in this country. Pundits are already talking about a post-racial reality. Trust, this so-called post-racial reality has not stemmed the tide of brothers into lockdown. By the way, there's a brother. I call him a brother because he's a white man trying to do for self. His name is Jack. I'm looking for his name to come up. If you have CNBC on, you have permission to turn it on. He just left. Anyway, this gentleman, Jack, I used to do Armstrong Williams' show with him. We had no idea who he was. I used to talk to Armstrong about him off air. And he said he's just a man aspiring to be a Republican consultant. He was a lawyer. God bless this man, Jack. You all have seen him. I don't agree with half of what he says, but he followed his dream. He's on CNBC, MSNBC. I saw this man. We were doing Armstrong's show in around 2001. And now he is a political, whatever they put underneath his name. That is my brother, a Caucasian who's doing for self, like the great Steven Spielberg, who you all want to accused of conspiratorial power. I don't even deal with that right now. I'm dealing with the fact that the great Steven Spielberg is doing for self. He's getting an Indian company to pump $600 or $500 million worth of equity, and he is going to take his DreamWorks operation to another studio. Now, I'll play that clip that we played earlier about black women having their own businesses. Cameron from Paterson, New Jersey says the minister has always spoken in clear fashion that teaches the listener. The way he answered Tim Russert was so black. His style is unapologetic and proud, so knowledgeable. That's why I listen to the Black Coffee Channel. You tell it straight, just like the minister. Cam, how you like this?
2 weeks from Tuesday, election day in America. After your Million Man March, more black men voted in the November elections than ever before. How would you advise blacks to vote 2 weeks from Tuesday for Democrats or Republicans running for Congress?
Oh, to advise somebody to vote for Satan or Lucifer is to still keep you in hell. The Democrats have been disloyal to the needs of black people, and the Republicans don't give a damn. So why should we vote for either one? If you don't give us justice, it's time for us to separate and do something for ourselves.
A separate black states, separate black territory.
We're going to have to do something. We can't sit around waiting for benevolent white people to give us handouts. We have the blessing of knowledge, wisdom, understanding, billions of dollars coming through our hands. We have to get up now and do something for ourselves, because white folk and benevolent Democrats and Republicans are not going to do for us what we should be uniting to do for ourselves.
That goes out to Cam. Just wanted to give you the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. I think that was 98. Robert Charles, was that 1998?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was 98 because of the election reference. You want to hear that one more time? You want to hear a true political independent? One more time, Brother Minister, please.
2 weeks from Tuesday, election day in America. After your Million Man March, more black men voted in the November elections than ever before. How would you advise blacks to vote 2 weeks from Tuesday for Democrats or Republicans running for Congress?
Oh, to advise somebody to vote for Satan or Lucifer is to still keep you in hell. The Democrats have been disloyal to the needs of black people, and the Republicans don't give a damn. So why should we vote for either one? If you don't give us justice, it's time for us to separate and do something for ourselves.
A separate black states, separate black territory.
We're going to have to do something. We can't sit around waiting for benevolent white people to give us handouts. we have of the blessing of knowledge, wisdom, understanding, billions of dollars coming through our hands. We have to get up now and do something for ourselves, because white folk and benevolent Democrats and Republicans are not going to do for us what we should be uniting to do for ourselves.
And this is why I'm defending Brother Barack Obama from your outrageous projection onto him, that somehow he is going to, as someone earlier mentioned, stop the problem of brothers on lockdown. You're going to have to force any politician, black, white, indifferent, or should I say white and non-white, according to the new Census Bureau distinctions. You're going to have to force any white or non-white political leader to do what you want them to do. It will not be because they like you. It will not be because they look like you. It will be because you effectively, like the great AIPAC, have an organized operation that places money, campaign contributions, votes, and media influence behind the cause of your choice. Ellie's off from Brooklyn. He's back for more CM Cap entrepreneurial advice. He says, Cedric, how about an online cable company? For example, cubicle workers can watch live TV on their computers for a subscription monthly fee. How does that sound? I can see it now. The Lawful Captive Channel, LLCC. Eleazar, you're on to something, brother. Just send me some more entrepreneurial questions. Log on to www.cmcap.com. The new Science of Business e-letter will be out soon. Subscribe to that. Reggie from Chicago, he says, peace, Cedric. I'm just tuning in. I have been reading various articles about Putin, Vladimir Putin, and his boys in the Wall Street Journal. He is a true gangster. He puts Dick Cheney to shame. Guidance and protection. Reggie from Chicago, you are right. Every day now, it seems that the Putin cabal in Russia is being exposed in the Wall Street Journal. There's some secretive advisor, someone involved in oil pipeline deals. Let me get into this now. I have found the new gangster of the week, and there is a Russian connection. Listen to this story carefully. An American basketball player, an American citizen who will be on the Russian Olympic team. This white woman is our gangster of the week. Find out why.
Becky Hammond's family preached the values of God and country growing up in South Dakota during the last decade of the Cold War.
You love your country, you love basketball. It makes sense to have a dream of going to the Olympics.
But this quintessential all-American girl and an all-star WNBA player won't be wearing the red, white, and blue uniform at this summer's Olympics. Becky Hammond will be the starting point guard for Team Russia, even though she doesn't speak Russian and has no Russian ancestry.
I knew my patriotism was definitely going to come under attack, and that's okay. I mean, like I said, I grew up in the middle of America. I know how people think, because that's how I think.
Some fans are angered.
Is that her country?
No.
Then I wouldn't be for that.
And the head coach of the U.S. women's national team, Ann Donovan, has called her a traitor. But now Team USA is toning down the criticism.
We look at this as an individual decision that Becky has made. And, you know, she's in the position to feel free to do as she pleases in that regard. She's playing within the rules.
Hammond spends half the year playing in the United States and in the offseason plays for a professional team in Moscow, which provided her with Russian citizenship. Professional women's basketball didn't exist when Becky Hammond was growing up, so playing in the Olympics was the pinnacle of a career. Today, Hammond is 31 and she feels it's her last chance to fulfill that dream. Despite being one of the most popular players in America,
I'm looking for a Russia jersey with Becky's name on it.
Hammond wasn't invited to try out for the U.S. team until she had already signed to play with the Russians.
So it's the gold medal match, Team USA, Team Russia, tied, and you shoot the last second shot, and you make it. How do you feel?
Of course, I ran through all these scenarios in my head, every scenario possible before I made this decision, so I had to be comfortable with it. And this is a basketball game. You know, I still love my country.
Becky Hammond says she'll take the shot and hopefully make it. For her, the Cold War ended long ago. Ed Lavandera, CNN, San Antonio.
How do you all feel about this? She's in the WNBA. She's an American citizen. She's playing on the Russian basketball team. Send me your thoughts on that. I nominate this Caucasian woman to be the gangster of the week. I think that's one of the most gangster things I've ever heard in my life. You're an American citizen, but you go to Russia. You can't make the American Olympic team. Brother Charles, you believe this? You can't make the American Olympic team, so hell, try out for the Russian team. How many of you all would do that? You love basketball that much, you don't want to let the dream go. All right, we're moving into our topic. Is the phenomenal rise of Senator Barack Obama now being used as a device to mask America's racial divide? Here's the article that got it popping. The June 14th Wall Street Journal called Fair Enough. Barack Obama's rise has Americans debating whether affirmative action has run its course. I'm going to read some of this article to you right now. Take a pause. You give me your comments. Says here, Stan Shane, a white student who attends community college in this working class Detroit suburb, supports Barack Obama for president. But he has no time for what he calls double standards and propagation of victim mentality. The fact that a black man can run for the position of the president of the United States of America only corroborates that there is enough opportunity and equality for great things like that to happen. This is what he says. And that there is no need to create special advantages for any demographic group. Electra Fulbright, a black small business consultant in prosperous Southfield, Michigan, couldn't disagree more. Obama's privileges and his accomplishments are minute compared to the black population at large, says Ms. Fulbright, who plans to vote for Senator Obama. When we talk about Obama, we are not talking about the average black American. There is injustice in this country, and until we correct it, we need affirmative action. Few issues have been as incendiary in the workplace and on college campuses as affirmative action, in large part because so many blacks and whites have been personally affected by affirmative action in ways both good and bad. Now, Senator Obama's rise is prompting some whites to ask and some blacks to fear this question. Does America still need affirmative action, given that an African American has made it to the top of the American political system? The question has been asked before, as other blacks have risen to high positions. But Senator Obama's swift ascent to the verge of the presidency may have created a turning point in the debate. The issue of affirmative action is likely to dog Senator Obama on the campaign trail as he seeks to win over white blue-collar voters in battleground states like Michigan and others. For many of these voters, affirmative action has been decisive since the 1970s. Ward Connolly, a prominent affirmative action opponent, is seeking to place anti-affirmative action referendums on the ballot in Arizona, Nebraska, and Colorado. Voters would be asked to ban preferential treatment of women and minorities in state university admissions, the filling of state-funded jobs, and awarding of state contracts. White anger over affirmative action has diminished as the Supreme Court has systematically narrowed the scope of programs in colleges and in the workplace. Still, the gap between black and white opinion remains wide. More than half of 57% of blacks, 57% say the country should make every effort to improve the position of blacks and minorities, even if it means giving preferential treatment. According to a poll conducted last year by the Pew Research Center, a nonpartisan Washington think tank that studies social attitudes, just 27% of whites agree with that view. The same poll shows that nearly half of the whites, 48%, believe the U.S. has gone too far in pushing equal rights in this country. Far fewer African Americans, 27%, agree. Opinions about affirmative action vary depending on how researchers word their questions. Support tends to grow, for example, when the question described the programs in more detail. But the Gallup polling firm says that regardless of the wording, all of its surveys on affirmative action show blacks overwhelmingly support it, while whites tend to be much more divided. Senator Obama's success has also stirred an uncomfortable debate within the black community over who has reaped the gains of affirmative action. Some argue the policies skew toward middle-class blacks instead of poor blacks and have favored too many individuals like Senator Obama, people with a biracial background, or the children of African and Caribbean immigrants, as opposed to blacks born in the U.S. All right, get ready, folks. Whether Ward Connolly gets this issue on referendums in those three states, Nebraska, Colorado, or Arizona, this now will be a wedge issue. And this is my segue into the Father's Day speech given by Senator Obama. Let me read your comments before I actually play the bulk of that speech. Now, those of you that want Senator Obama to win and you support him and you've been tolerant of certain things that he's done that you say he, quote unquote, has to do in order to win. Where are you on the issue of affirmative action? Does Senator Obama have to say things like Bill Clinton, mend it, but don't end it? I mean, how far are you willing to go to get the win? You say it's okay for Senator Obama to have to distance himself from revered figures in the black community. Is it okay for him to distance himself from policies? Fidel from Muskegon, Michigan says Obama earned the loyalty of blacks by repudiating Dr. Wright, Minister Farrakhan, Father Flager, and his church Trinity. He's talking about whites, rather, I believe. He says Obama has earned the loyalty of whites by repudiating Dr. Wright, Minister Farrakhan, Father Flager, and his church Trinity. He has promised blacks nothing. He pledged $32 billion to Jews, and they would never vote for him in the 90 percentile like blacks. Brother Vernon, Columbia, Maryland, he says, Assalamu alaikum, Brother Cedric, I'm thankful for you and what you do. You've inspired me to start a movement among my family, beginning at our family reunion this month. Inshallah, you will have the ear of a strong, organized group ready to make a righteous footprint on this world. I hope to talk to you soon. See, Brother Vernon is talking about turning that family reunion into a private equity venture capital fund, pooling resources. Rod Ginyar from Culver City, California, he says Barack is such a big, broad thinker. It's his subordinates that will serve the food at his table setting. And his VP is not the most important in the White House. It will be his Secretary of State. And that person could very well indeed and should very well be Dr. Susan Rice. What do you all think? If Senator Obama has to, in order to win, distance himself from affirmative action, would that be acceptable to you? Do some of you draw the line there? Rod Ginyard about my Gangster of the Week nominee, Becky Hammon, the WNBA American basketball player who is going to be on the Russian Olympic team. Rod Ginyard says if Becky Hammon is smart, she'll take her story to Hollywood, which is exactly what I think she's planning on doing. She will not make a difference or gain the kind of paper this will generate unless she does something bold like this. Fidel from Muskegon, Michigan says Obama is the perfect symbol without substance. I'm confident Obama will terminate affirmative action if and when it becomes politically expedient. However, he supports welfare for Israel to the tune of $32 billion. I'm trying to find an article about that speech that Obama, our brother, gave at the AIPAC convention. I want to show you who the advisors were on that. Oh, don't be shy. And any comment is welcome. Pro Obama supporters. I'm asking the question to how far is this going to go in order for our brother to become electable? Jason from Chicago, he says, hey, Cedric, are you familiar with the GM cars that people are driving in Brazil that run totally on alternative fuel? They say that Brazil has divested itself of using the world's gasoline altogether. Yes, I've actually seen people on CNBC saying that America needs to do what Brazil is doing. So, yes, I've seen reports on this. Even the BBC has bigged up Brazil and their supposedly socialist economy. Isn't it amazing now how on this oil issue? It is the quote unquote rogue regimes, the Islamic terrorist states, the socialist countries in Central South America and Africa that hold the power. Related to that is another magazine I try to put you all to up on, Global Finance. We read from Global Finance a month or two ago. Cover of the June 2008 issue is Africa. Into Africa, the lost continent finds favor with global investors. Let me give you a taste of this before we hear Senator Obama's Father's Day speech. Article is called The Found Continent. Long ignored by mainstream investors and corporations, Africa has suddenly found itself in the spotlight. Its resilience in the recent credit crunch is just part of the reason. Africa has long been the forgotten continent. Despite enormous wealth and resources, it has historically been blighted by the legacy of colonialism, political corruption, and economic mismanagement. Now Africa has been rediscovered. China and India are leading the way in tapping the continent's commodity wealth, fueling a boom in trade. Meanwhile, the economic reform is helping to increase domestic consumption, raising hopes that Africa may enjoy consistent long-term growth. To be sure, numerous threats remain on the horizon. The possibility of instability is never far away, and the bloodshed in Kenya following a disputed election highlights how even countries perceived as stable on the continent are vulnerable to political tensions that can have disastrous economic consequences. More generally, escalating food prices could yet do more or much to jeopardize hard-won fiscal responsibility among many African states and prompt social confrontation. Moreover, there are a number of notably successful economies in Africa, or while there are, it would be wrong to characterize the entire continent as enjoying a political, cultural, and economic rebirth. That runs me into today's Wall Street Journal. In Africa, democracy gains amid turmoil. This is what the Wall Street Journal says. This is today's issue. In late March, Noel Katutwa's colleagues fanned out across Zimbabwe to monitor the country's presidential elections. The democracy advocates quickly published their tally, projecting President Robert Mugabe had lost his first election since taking power in 1980. We expected to be arrested immediately, he says in an interview, but we wanted to make sure our election was legitimate. Mr. Kutuwa's work in Zimbabwe is part of a shift obscured by his country's bloody election season. Democracy is making gradual gains in sub-Saharan Africa. The trend is driven by a cadre of activists, armed with little more than determination and cheap cell phones, who are outmaneuvering Africa's ruling strongmen. African democracy has faced jarring setbacks recently. In Kenya, tribal violence killed more than 1,000 people and threatened to tear the nation apart after contested elections earlier this year. In Nigeria, the ruling party blatantly stuffed ballot boxes in national polls last year, according to international observers. In Zimbabwe today, opposition party and human rights groups report nearly daily acts of intimidation carried out by Mugabe supporters. Since the election, the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, says at least 60 members have been killed, including four who had their eyes and tongues cut out. The government denies participation in the violence. Morgan, I forget how to say his name, the opposition leader, has been detained by police five times. Mr. Mugabe raised the stakes this week, promising war if his opponent triumphs in the hotly contested runoff scheduled for June 27th, and accused the opposition of fomenting the violence. On Monday, Mr. Mugabe vowed to hold on to power even if he loses. If he acts on that threat, Africa's democratic march will have suffered a significant blow. But in many ways, the unrest stirring Zimbabwe and other nations is coming because democracy has chalked up modest advances. Mr. Mugabe's ruling party lost its stranglehold. And do you see the argument this person's making, which started out, I was reading from the other magazine. This is what you call rewriting a narrative. I'm going to read that last part. In many ways, the unrest stirring Zimbabwe and other nations is coming because democracy has chalked up modest advances. Mr. Mugabe's ruling party lost its stranglehold on parliament. This is the Wall Street Journal here. In the March 29 vote, and the president, who international observers and opponents accuse of rigging previous elections, was forced into an embarrassing runoff. It says here, the democratic gains across sub-Saharan Africa come amid the fastest economic growth the region has seen in three decades. Foreign investment is flooding in on the back of soaring prices for the oil, metals, and minerals that are plentiful across the continent. The boom, coupled with the region's democratic progress, offers some hope that after a period of post-colonial turmoil, sub-Saharan Africa may be slowly emerging into a more peaceful and prosperous era. Are you kidding me? I mean, that is convoluted. Now, I'm not going to go any further on Zimbabwe. Go to blackelectric.com's front page, and you will see the new report put out by Trans Africa. It's called The Zimbabwe Elections, A Dream Deferred. It's a 6-page special report. It just came out. Read it. I like what Trans Africa is trying to do. They say, here in the U.S., we are working to help people move beyond simplistic interpretations of Zimbabwe's crisis. Again, here in the U.S., this is Trans Africa talking, we are moving to help people move beyond simplistic interpretations of Zimbabwe's crisis. What I just read to you, cover story in today's Wall Street Journal, is a simplistic interpretation. They're actually trying to say that these problems don't have anything to do with 200,000% inflation, but rather they're the outgrowth or growing pains of democratic improvement and foreign direct investment that has economies booming because of commodity prices. Get out of here. You have more murder than ever going on in Zimbabwe and South Africa, and we're supposed to be applauding democracy. This is what I'm talking about. The three BS panacea solutions for Africa. One, charity because of famine. Two, free and fair elections from democracy. And three, foreign direct investment. You just heard two of the BS triangle, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. Okay, the great Wall Street Journal putting out BS. Now here we go. Father's Day speech. Not the media's sound bites. Here's Senator Obama. We'll talk about this in hour number three, but I want you to get the bulk of what he actually said on Sunday.
Of all the rocks upon which we build our lives, we are most dependent on the family. The family is that most important foundation. And we are called to recognize and honor how critical every father is to that foundation. They are teachers and coaches, they're mentors, and they're role models. They are examples of success and the men who constantly push us towards success. But if we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are also missing. Too many fathers are MIA. Too many fathers are AWOL. Missing from too many lives and too many homes. They've abandoned their responsibilities. They're acting like boys instead of men. And the foundations of our family have suffered because of it. You and I know this is true everywhere, but nowhere is it more true than in the African American community. We know that more than half of all black children live in single-parent households. Half, a number that's doubled since we were children. We know the statistics that children who grow up without a father are five times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime. They're nine times more likely to drop out of school, 20 times more likely to end up in prison. They're more likely to have behavioral problems or run away from home or become teen parents because the father wasn't in the home. The foundations of our community and our country are weaker because of this. Think about it. How many times over the last year has this city lost a child at the hand of another child? How many times have our hearts stopped in the middle of the night with the sounds of gunshot or sirens? How many teenagers have we seen hanging out on street corners instead of hanging out in the classroom? How many are sitting languishing in prison when they should be working or at least looking for a job? How many in this generation are we willing to lose to poverty or violence or addiction? How many? We can't simply write these problems off to past injustices. Those injustices are real. There's a reason why our families are in disrepair, and some of it has to do with a tragic history. But we can't keep on using that as an excuse. Some of it has to do with the failures of our government, and those failures are real. But we can't keep on using that as an excuse. Yes, sir. Yes, we need fewer guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have them. Yes, we need more money for our schools and more outstanding teachers in the classroom and more after-school programs for our children. Yes, we need more jobs and more job training and more opportunity in our community. We know all that. That's why I'm running for president of the United States of America. We know we need to bring about change in America. We know that. But the change we need is not just going to come from government. It's not just going to come from a president. It's going to come from us. It's going to come from each and every one of us. We need families to raise our children. We need fathers to recognize that responsibility doesn't just end at conception. That doesn't just make you a father. What makes you a man is not the ability to have a child. Any fool can have a child. That doesn't make you a father. It's the courage to raise a child that makes you a father. And listen, to all the mothers out there, you need help. You need help. We need to help all those mothers out there who are raising their kids by themselves. The mothers who drop them off at school and go to work and pick them up in the afternoon and work another shift and get dinner and make lunches and pay the bills and fix the house and protect the family and do all the things that a parent is supposed to do. So many women in our community are doing this in a heroic fashion. We're so proud of all those single moms who are out there doing just incredible work, but they need support. They shouldn't have to be doing it all by themselves. They need another parent in the home. Their children need another parent in the home. That's what keeps their foundation strong. It's what keeps the foundation of our country strong. And I know what it means to have an absent parent. You know, my father wasn't in the house when I was growing up. I have to say, my circumstances weren't as tough as they are for many young people today. Because even though my father left us when I was 2 years old, and I only knew him by the letters he wrote and the stories my family told, I was growing up in Hawaii. Hawaii is not quite as tough as the South Side. I'm just telling the truth. And I had two wonderful grandparents to help my mother, grandparents from Kansas who poured everything they had into me, helping my mother to raise my sister and me. They worked to teach us about love and respect and the obligations that we have to one another. And I have to admit, I messed up more often than I should have, but I got plenty of second chances. And even though we didn't have a lot of money, I had love and an education, scholarships that gave me the opportunity to go to some of the best schools in the country. See, a lot of children don't get those chances. There's no margin for error in the lives of so many of our children. They've got to have everything going for them. They've got to have mama rooting for them, but they've got to have daddy rooting for them too. I understand my story is different, but I know the toll that being a single parent took on my mother. How she struggled at times to pay the bills. How she was embarrassed sometimes to go to the store with food stamps because she wanted to make sure that we had enough to eat. How she struggled to give us the things that other kids had. Sometimes I'd come back home, you know, children don't always think about things the right way, and I'd complain about how Johnny had this or Jimmy had that. And I can only imagine how that made her feel. She struggled to play all the roles that both parents are supposed to play. She had to be the disciplinarian all the time. And I know the toll it took on me, not having a father in the house. The hole in your heart when you don't have a male figure in the home that can guide you and lead you and set a good example for you. So I resolved many years ago that it was my obligation to break the cycle. That if I could do anything in life, I would be a good father to my children. That if I could do anything, I would give them that rock, that foundation on which to build their lives. That would be the greatest gift I could offer them. And I say this knowing that I've been an imperfect father, knowing that I've made mistakes. I'll continue to make more. Wishing that I could be a home more for my girls and my wife than I am right now. I say this knowing all of these things because even though we're all going to be imperfect parents, imperfect fathers, even as we all face difficult circumstances at times in our lives, there's still certain lessons we have to strive to live as fathers. Whether we're black or white, whether we're rich or poor, whether we're from the South Side or the wealthiest suburbs. The first lesson I think that all of us have to embrace is the idea of responsibility. That the idea of taking responsibility for your actions and taking responsibility for those that you love. And I know of no better example than this than my father-in-law, Michelle's dad, Frazier Robinson. Frazier Robinson, at the age of 30, was stricken with multiple sclerosis. By the time I met him, by the time I knew him, he had to walk with a couple of walkers, a couple of canes, everywhere he went. And he never went to college because he grew up at a time when there weren't a lot of opportunities. So he worked at a water filtration plant downtown, right by Navy Pier. And he worked there all his life. And he'd have to wake up an hour early because of his disability, an hour earlier than anybody else, just to get to work on time. But he never missed a day's work. He never missed his son's basketball games. He never missed his daughter's recitals. He was always there for them, and he always loved them, and always rooted for them and inspired them. He took responsibility. He could have used his disability as an excuse. Just like he could have used racism as an excuse for not caring for his children, but he was there all the time. That's a lesson that we have to embrace in our community. Taking responsibility, no matter what the hardships, to be the kind of father that our children need us to be. The second lesson that I've taken is setting an example of excellence for our children. Because if we want to set high expectations for them, we've also got to set some high expectations for ourselves. You know, it's sometimes, you know, it's interesting during this process of running for president. You remember at the beginning, People were wondering, how come he doesn't have all the support in the African-American community? You remember that?
Well,
that was when I wasn't black enough. Now I'm too black. But you remember that? You remember that bitch? Y'all remember. And what was interesting was how many people would come up to me and say, oh, Barack, we love you, man. We're rooting for you, but we just don't think that a black man can be elected president.
Well,
I mean, we had already defeated ourselves.
Yes, sir.
Before we even started. We didn't set high enough expectations for ourselves. We believe that somebody else can do it, but we can't do it. And that filters down to our children. That filters down to our children. When we set low expectations for ourselves, we set them low for our children.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
Change, they say change is dangerous. Errors, as a king standing on the terrace, while his partner pointing up at the rightful man. Coward shooter, never know when your life will end then.